Broadcasting from the Health Sciences Campus at the University of Southern California, this is OT Talk with host Rob Russo.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very first episode of OT Talk. I'm starting this podcast really as a way for me to explore the world of occupational therapy. I just wanted a chance to interview some of the bright minds we have in this field, and hopefully you'll learn something along the way as well. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future episodes of the show, feel free to send me an email at uscotpodcast@gmail.com. I'm excited to kick things off with a special guest this week, Dr. Samia Rafidi, a former instructor of mine. On top of her duties as a clinical instructor here at the University of Southern California, Dr. Rafidi also works as a clinician in an adult rehab setting, and she serves a very important role on the Occupational Therapy Association of California, OTAC. So we'll be exploring all of those roles as we talk to her today on this show. I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Rafidi. Thank you for joining me today. Dr. Rafidi, what's up? What have you been up to lately?
Me? Well, let's see. I've been preparing for class and making sure we're ready for the next week. These new courses, this new curriculum at USC, it's made us shift the way we do things a little bit. And so, yeah, I'm hanging, just doing my thing and getting ready for next week.
Well, it's keeping you on your toes. I'm glad to see that. Let's talk about something that you are very, very passionate about. Every time I hear you speak on this, I know you could speak for hours about professional association. What's the big deal? Why is that so important?
Wow. I don't even know where to start, Rob. Let's see. Professional associations and in our membership in our professional associations is probably the one most important thing we can do as occupational therapy practitioners to ensure that occupational therapy will be here. I think that, so we don't even have to talk about how healthcare is changing. Healthcare is moving, and there's change that will happen. Who knows what form and what shape it will take, but occupational therapy needs to be at the table. And I think the more and more I'm in the clinic and the more and more I'm exposed to some of the legislative battles that we deal with as a state association in my experiences with OTAC, let alone our national association and the experiences that I hear about when we hear Dr. Clark give us an update on sensory integration and some of these big topics that are really put under the microscope and really questioned in terms of legitimacy and validity, then I get heated. I get heated like no other because I love what I do, and I love what occupational therapy has to offer society and what we have to offer people. And if we're not at the table and if we're not just as strong as our counterparts and all of these other allied health professionals that we work with, if we're not equally as strong, then we will get taken over. Our practice will get eaten alive. And we have solid examples of other disciplines who want to claim different aspects of our scope of practice, whether it's activities of daily living or it's therapeutic exercise or it's instrumental activities of daily living or leisure and recreation. There's always another discipline that will want to do what we do and get paid for that. And I think we have to be very careful about always keeping occupation at the forefront and utilizing occupation as a therapeutic medium so that people know that we are occupational therapists, that we're not confused with physical therapy, and that we're not confused with nursing or speech and language pathology or recreational therapy, because all of those wonderful disciplines come to the table with their expertise. And I think historically, our profession, our students were never groomed to be advocates. We never learned to join our national association and what that meant, or our state associations and what that meant. And now that we are sort of seeing the ramifications of that and feeling the pressure, I think it's the most important part of a curriculum. I think the students need to come in, and I think on day one, they need to understand that You need a career insurance, just like you have health insurance. At USC, there is not one student on this campus without health insurance. Everyone who's a student at USC has to have proof of health insurance, or they sign up for USC insurance when they register for classes. And what I think is that every student who's in an OT program and every practitioner who does practice clinical occupational therapy or whatever kind of occupational therapy, that they sign up for their career insurance. And the only way that you can do that, it's our only power arm. It's the only way that our voices are heard in any kind of policy or legislation on a national and or state level. So if you're not a member of your national association and you're not a member of your state association, those dollars don't go forward, and they can't use that money to fund our lobbying and to fund our defending our scope of practice. Our scope of practice is in jeopardy and is at risk of being chomped on by all these different professions on a daily basis. And we have to send people to Sacramento, and we have to send people to Washington, D.C., and we have to send people to every state capital in order to fight those battles. And if they don't have people to do, people can't just volunteer for these kinds of roles. These are important roles, and we need to pay people to go do that. And if we can't, then OT is not represented, and we continue to disempower ourselves. So I think it's a matter of empowerment. I think when people know why membership is so important and they see where OT is disempowered, I think there's no choice. I don't think you're left with any option then to believe that joining your national and your state associations is the answer.
So why don't we have more then? Because I'm trying to remember the numbers you threw out at me, but it's a fraction of the current practitioners we have that are actually members of their national association or state association. Why do you think that is, that that's happened?
Okay, so I think that's a tough question. I think it's a sensitive question. And I think for a long time, like I said, I don't think our profession groomed our new clinicians or our students to really appreciate and understand advocacy and legislation. We're changing. Times are changing now. I guarantee you that with the AOTA president right now, Dr. Florence Clark's leadership, and I think with the way we're going, it's going to change. But historically, we have been a very disempowered profession. And I think that Dr. Clark, when she gave her talk on power, she gave a talk on power a couple of years back, and she compared occupational therapy with nursing. And nursing has historically been a very disempowered profession and sort of in the shadows of the physician. And a lot of things point to that disempowerment, not only the gender roles being primarily women nurses working primarily with men physicians and the gender differences, but also the fact that nursing has played this role because of its lack of power in its association and its autonomy and its body of research and all of these other things. So she compared OT and nursing, and there was a lot of similarity, and it was actually kind of scary when you just heard her say, give us the reasons why our profession is in the situation that it is in right now, where we have, you know, 35% of our, approximately 35% of our OT practitioners in the nation who are members of the National Association. And now these statistics are from about a year ago, so it could be different right now, but the last numbers that I heard, there are about 140,000 OT practitioners in the United States, and only 35% of those practitioners are members of the National Association. And of those 35%, about 40% are students. And who knows if those students continue to join after they leave school? And who knows why those other 100,000 people are not members? And I think it's because they just it was just never a part of their upbringing in the profession. And then in the same breath with OTAC, with the Occupational Therapy Association of California, again, my statistics coming from a year ago, we have only about 12 to 15% of our practitioners in the state who are members of our state association. And about 7% of that number are COTAs, are certified occupational therapy assistants, and about 12% are occupational therapists. So I don't have the student numbers in front of me, but that is directly correlated with the amount of representation that we have in our state and in our country. And according to a source that I just confirmed this with, occupational therapists have two lobbyists that go and do the work that we need them to do in our capital, on Capitol Hill. We have two lobbyists. And she actually told me that sometimes they can dedicate 0.5. So sometimes it's 2.5 people. Whereas our physical therapy counterparts, they have 7 lobbyists. They have 7 people who can go knock door to door, attend meetings, sit at the table, bargain for power, bargain for insurance payments, discuss reimbursements, discuss durable medical equipment, discuss home health care, and all of these things that mean so much to our clients. They have 7 people. We have 2. Do you know how many more doors they knock on and how many more tables they sit at and how many more chairs they occupy in these very important meetings? Oh, it means a lot. And it's dangerous for us to think that, I feel like it's dangerous for our profession to think that we can only send 2 people out there, sometimes 2.5, when we need 10, 15, 20, 30, 50. We need an army to get down there and advocate for what we do. But we can't do that if we don't have members, because it's embarrassing to say you're representing. I would think it would be embarrassing for a lobbyist to say, we have over 140,000 practitioners in this country, but I'm here representing 43,000 of them. Where are the other 100,000? Do they not think that this is important enough? Do they not need their careers? Do they not think that their licensure and their scope of practice is important enough that they would spend, I don't know what it is, I don't remember, $300 a year? That's less than $1 a day. Think of all the coffee we buy. I am guilty of going to Einstein's almost every other day to buy a large mocha, non-fat milk, and hold the whip. And that cost me almost $5 a day. Now, if I could calculate how much money I spend on coffee, I could probably fund 3 people to be a member of AOTA. And I think about the students who complain that they don't have money, and I think about the clinicians who complain that they don't have the money. And then I ask, how much coffee do you buy in 1 week? And I think we could find a way to make those dollars available in our monthly budgets or our yearly budgets or however you do your budget, because it's just like health insurance. It's just like dental insurance. It's just like eye insurance. It's just like car insurance. This is insurance for your career. If you don't have an income, guess what? You can't pay for any of those things anyway. So just do it. Just do it. Join your national association. It doesn't make any sense not to.
And it's not just about joining the National Association,
the state as
because
well.
The state is really important there. Because I can see someone saying, oh, you know, the National Association is very important. It's national, but my state, you know, give or take. But that's really important for setting the scope of practice and many other things, right?
The state association is the first line of defense for your licensure and your scope of practice in the state of California. And let me tell you something, California is like no other state in the country, because there are so many things that go on in this state where we set the precedent for the rest of the country. So if PT is fighting to get activities of daily living under their scope of practice and it passes in the state of California, guess what's going to happen everywhere else in the country? And if we can't defend our scope and if we can't defend our licensure right here in the state, what's going to happen with the national? You need both. These are your two best friends, is your state association and your national association. And I want to say, people have their reasons of why they don't join. I don't know those reasons. I know people have financial problems. I know people have personal issues. Everyone's got an issue. Everyone's got problems. We're all in the same boat. But if we don't have our jobs, we're in a bigger we have a bigger problem. So I think that I would encourage and I would ask every single practitioner and every single student to prioritize their association, their memberships to the national and state associations every year, and to support those two groups and to really believe that that is our security for our careers and to ensure us that we will continue moving and doing what we do best and helping people, because that's what we want to do. Because if we don't have If we don't have our defenses and if we don't have our advocates, then we're in trouble.
Yeah, I think it's almost a complete mind shift, because it's easy to see this battle, this political battle, as being, you know, for me especially, it's over my head. You know, I can't get involved in that personally, but this is important for the survival of our practice. So absolutely, it's something everyone needs to get involved in, regardless of whether the politics of it are beyond what you want to get involved with.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned that, I just pulled up a memorandum that was sent to us last year from Chuck Wilmarth, who's the Director of State Affairs and Reimbursement and Regulatory Policy. And it identifies some key issues for each state legislative sessions. And it's just shocking. It'll blow your mind away if you looked at some of these issues and if you looked at some of the scope of practice challenges where we're being challenged by athletic trainers, we're being challenged by behavior analysts, and we're being challenged by physical therapists every day. And everyone's fighting for dollars, and everybody wants to say, we're doing this better, so you should reimburse our services and not those people. Because if another discipline can do it for this much less money, insurance companies are going to all move in that direction, and then we lose. So when we look at these issues, I don't know, I can give you just a few of these issues. It's scary. Athletic trainers, audiologists, behavior analysts, developmental therapists, optometrists who are doing low vision rehabilitation services could soon take over roles that occupational therapists are doing. Orthotics and prosthetics. Physical therapy, of course, is one very powerful, powerful counterpart for us, who we are, I think, constantly experiencing these kinds of challenges with. Recreational therapists, speech and language pathologists, and physicians. And so there's issues, and I have this whole packet, and I don't know that this is the right place for it, but every one of those professions has a scope of practice challenge, and we've got to meet it. And we can't do that unless we can send someone to Sacramento, unless we can send someone to Capitol Hill. And we can't do that unless people are members of the state and national associations.
So hopefully you're listening and you want to join your national association. How do you do that? That's the American Occupational Therapy Association.
So it's AOTA.org, or you call 1-800-SAY-AOTA and you tell them, I would like to be a member. And you have many benefits. Of course, we can get into all of the online resources and all the blogs and all these connections and networking. You know what? You can do that anywhere. That's not even where the marketing needs to go anymore. The marketing needs to simply be, if you care about your career and if you care about your professional future, you will join AOTA, because this is the only assurance that you have that we will continue to exist and be powerful in healthcare.
So all that's pretty serious, but give us one hope. Give us some optimism for the future. Why should we have optimism for the future of occupational therapy?
Optimism for the future. You don't have to ask an OT about optimism, because it pours out of our ears and our noses and any other orifice you want to talk about. Optimism. Wow. You know what? Preventative occupational therapy, that's the ticket. It's coming. It's here. It's amazing. I think that's going to give a lot of different avenues for occupational therapists to take. We're always talking about rehabilitation and helping people after they are hurt, or helping people after the fact. But now there's this new avenue that we can go down, and we can get to our clients before they get sick, before they have these chronic illnesses. And I think that's amazing. There's a lot of optimism with preventative OT and OT working in primary care. There's also a lot of optimism in the research that's happening in our profession right here at USC. And I can speak about this because I'm here. And I'm sure there's wonderful research happening in many, many other universities and institutes. But we've got research studies on the well elderly part two. We've got research studies on the pressure ulcer prevention study, on autism, on sensory integration. There's so much going on that we have so much to offer society, and we are stepping up our game with the research, the evidence-based practice, bridging research and clinical work. We're becoming more powerful in so many settings, and I think that that kind of work pushes our profession beyond where it's ever been. I think OT is in a really good place right now. And I think we're more powerful and we're stronger than we've ever been. And now that we are teaching our students advocacy and we are teaching them the importance of legislation and policy and their national and state associations, I think our students are the optimism for this profession. I am sitting with you and you are going to be a leader. And I know that. And one day when I don't think I'll ever retire, but maybe I won't be working as many hours as I do in a week. And
I'd like to see that happen.
I don't know. You know, I honestly don't know how I would live. OT is like air. It's like oxygen. I don't think I can be me without it. I don't think I can be Samia without OT. And I think I said that. But one day, Rob is going to run for president of OTAC. One day, Rob will run for president of the American Occupational Therapy Association. And I want to be sure to be on Rob's side. And I want to be sure that every student that sits in my classroom and every student that sits in any classroom at this university that is in occupational therapy understands that importance and realizes that they influence the people around them, and that when they get out in those clinics, they're advocating and they're fighting hard for their patients, and they're writing letters to the insurance companies about why this person needs a transfer tub bench or this kind of splint, or that they're pushing to get hired at a pediatric clinic because they are the ones that truly do sensory integration, and that they can stand up for their practice and defend their scope, and that they will be our leaders. And so my optimism is every student now needs to know these things, and shame on us, shame on my generation and the generation before me that didn't make sure that that was the case. But I don't think we knew any better. Maybe it's not shame on them. Maybe we just didn't know, but we know now. And if we don't act on it, we're at fault. And I need to be sure that OT exists when I'm old and gray. I'm already starting to get gray, but I need to make sure that you carry it on. And I need to make sure that every student carries it on, because once we stop and once we can't volunteer our hours to OTAC and AOTA for whatever reasons, we need to make sure that our students and our future leaders are doing it. And so that's my hope. That's the optimism. It's the students. It's the young blood. It's the fresh blood. You're all energized. You're all very, because you have this civic duty. It's in your generational cohort. You have a civic duty. And I think those duties line up with your careers and your professions. And who knows what's going to happen with the economy, but we want our jobs and we need our careers and people will need us. And so it's going to sound so cheesy when I say this, but the students are the future and they are the optimism and they are our hope. And so I think that we have that to look forward to, that there's going to be this new wave of blood and energy and passion and dedication and legislation and advocacy. And you are all going to get it done in ways that we couldn't or in ways that we didn't.
Well, when you're old and gray and you need occupational therapy, I'll be there for you.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Rob. So funny.
You're listening to OT Talk. Send any questions, comments, or ideas for future shows to uscotpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be right back.
We know you as a teacher, as a clinical professor here at the University of Southern California, but let's go into the setting, the practice setting that you have experience in. Kind of describe where you came from with that and what kind of current experience you have with that.
Sure. I started out working in an acute care hospital in Cincinnati. That was one of my first OT jobs. And I used to run around onto the medical surgical floors and provide services for people who were in the hospital for whatever reasons. I would see people who were recovering from strokes, brain injury, spinal cord injury, people who had general debility because of pneumonia or sepsis, some kind of infection. I would see people who have back surgery, knee surgeries, hip surgeries, lots of orthopedic needs. Anyone who went to the hospital. So that was one area in the hospital where I worked. I also covered outpatients, and I would see a lot of people who had needs for hand therapy and upper extremity management, a lot of strengthening, range of motion, edema management, scar management. those kinds of things. Of course, I always try to incorporate the occupation into it because I like to be occupation-based and work from that kind of top-down approach. But sometimes you fall into those biomechanical, you know, we got to do these exercises and all these reps. But I was reminded by a PT that I was dating at the time. He used to ask me, yeah, OTs and PTs sometimes date. I was reminded by this PT. It was funny because he's like, all right, Sam, so what's the difference between PT and OT? Because what you're doing in there is exactly what I would do. And that's when I thought, dum, dum, dum. Like the age-old question of what's the difference between PT and OT? And I said, because I do occupation. And he's like, no, Sam, you really look like me in there. And so that's when I really had to change how I did things and make sure that it looked like occupational therapy, where we were doing meaningful activities and occupations and not just exercise. So I did a lot of that. And I also covered in the acute rehab unit, where 3 hours of therapy are given to patients 5 days a week. And that's a little more intensive therapies for people. And some of the primary patients who we saw had diagnoses like stroke, brain injury, amputation, spinal cord injury, who really needed intensive therapy before going home. So I would cover on that unit every once in a while. I felt like that was a really nice place to start as a new clinician, because you get to get a taste of just about everything. And then I worked at a nursing home for a while in Cincinnati. And I also used to work on the psych unit. I used to cover the psych unit. And so I got a little taste of mental health. Of course, there's always mental health in everything you do. I think that's never something that's excluded, but it was a psych unit. And I did some running around there too. So that's kind of where I got started. And I just fell in love with the adult rehab population and stuck with it pretty much. I feel very comfortable in that setting. I really enjoy going to continuing education courses, learning more about evaluations, assessments, intervention approaches. I do have my certified brain injury specialty certification, which is very cool. And I'm hoping to get more under my belt, because I think the more you can have those kinds of specialty intervention approaches, the more marketable you are. And I think you can work just about anywhere and feel very confident in your skills. I think that's one thing for new grads, is sometimes they don't feel very confident in their skills. So having extra training, extra mentoring, extra certification, I think really helps. And that helped me a lot when I was first getting started. So at this point in my career, so ever since then, it's always been adults and older adults. But at this point in my career, because I'm on the faculty here full time, I work as a per diem clinician at Good Samaritan Hospital downtown. And that's primarily acute care inpatient hospital, where I work with folks who are in the hospital for short amounts of time. Unfortunately, our rehab unit and our skilled nursing unit closed because of financial reasons. And so we don't have as many patient needs and the staff needs. And so I don't work as much, but I'm hoping to continue doing my per diem therapy while I'm teaching, because I don't think that I could teach clinical occupational therapy without practicing it. And that was one reason why I did get my clinical doctorate, was because I really believe that you have to marry the two worlds. You need the academic side and you need the clinical side, and you need to bring the research into practice, and you need to take practice into the classroom. And I think that having that degree helps me do that. And I can't do one without the other. And in my heart, I can't do one without the other, because I love patient care and I love my patients. And I don't think I can be Samia Rafidi without being an OT, practicing OT. And now I think I can't be Samia Rafidi without being a professor, because I've really grown to love my role here. And I really have strong connections with the students and the student body. And it's fun. I thrive on it. I look forward to every day. I look forward to every week. And it's challenging. I can't say that I ever feel stuck. I can't say that I ever feel like I'm on autopilot. Like sometimes people just get really stuck in their jobs, and that is never the case here, because there's always something new. There's always something challenging. And then you have to keep up with the literature. You have to keep up with what's going on, because evidence-based practice is what it is right now. And we have to be able to back up and legitimize what we do in the clinic with what we do on the research side. So having a position like this really helps me keep on top of things and know what's happening, and so that I can be best prepared in both settings, in the classroom and in the clinic.
So as you finish that delicious looking grape, tell me about how you got into teaching. That's what I really want to hear about.
How I got into teaching. I think that probably started when I was in elementary school. I used to go back in the summers. It started in third grade, actually, with my third grade teacher, Mrs. Kyler. And she would ask me to help her grade spelling tests. And I used to... You're laughing and it's making me laugh. I used to grade spelling tests in third grade. So I would go to school and it was like around the block from where my parents, where we lived. I would pick up the stack of papers and because she taught summer school and I would grade these papers. And my dad looked at me and said, "You're destined to be a professor." And like, I remember him saying it and I always thought, I don't want to be a professor. I want to be a doctor, you know, because I knew I wanted to go into healthcare. So
wait, at the age of that young, you knew you wanted to go into healthcare? Mm-hmm, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm, third grade. Because I think that our culture, whenever we talked about what we wanted to do when we were grown up, it would be, you know, you have to be a doctor, or you have to be a lawyer or an architect. And I think that's very cultural because my parents moved to the United States in order to have better opportunities in order for us to go to school. And we were always pushed to strive for the highest degree, strive for the best of whatever you're doing, get the biggest degree you can, make us proud, be a doctor, be an attorney, be an architect, you know? So I always thought, well, you know, people need doctors and they help people. And anyway, that's another story. But he told me I was going to be a teacher one day. And I thought, I'm not going to be a teacher. So I kept going back to Mrs. Kyler, every summer, and I would help her grade. And then she gave me more than spelling tests. She gave me math tests, and then she gave me science tests. And so I started with the red pen way back in the day. And so all through junior high and elementary school, I kind of was involved in student government, president of the Key Club and the French Club and the student body and whatever you name it. I tried to do it because I don't know, I enjoyed it. And I was kind of an overachiever. And I think my parents pushed us in that direction. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing. I got a lot of great scholarships. I went to the Ohio State University on a free ride. You know, in fact, they paid me back money to get books from this grant and the scholarship that I won. So I was really happy with that. And then when I came back for my master's degree, Dr. Taguchi Meyer sat down with me because she was coordinating new admissions for the OTD program. And I was interested in doing the OTD, but I had to get a master's degree first because I came in with a bachelor's degree. And that was back in the day when you could get a bachelor's degree in OT. So she said, well, you have an option. You can take an elective. And one of the electives, since you're a clinician already, and a lot of the students that you're going to have in class are not clinicians yet. So, you know, you might consider doing a one-on-one with one of the professors here. And one of the courses was called Advanced Physical Disabilities with Teaching Experience. And it was Dr. McLaughlin Gray. And I thought, she looks awesome. And this seems like a really cool opportunity. And I would love to do that. So it wasn't like I was a TA in the class. I was a master's student, but I sat in on all the lectures, so I heard everything again. I admired Dr. McLaughlin Gray's teaching style. I learned a lot about her teaching style, and then I also had opportunities to teach in the labs. And I don't remember if I actually did a lecture in the big lecture room, but I think I led labs, and it was a long time ago. I don't remember, but I loved it, and I thought, this is really a lot of fun, and I'm feeling very energized by sharing my clinical experience, by having an opportunity to keep up with recent evidence, recent literature in the field, and learning new approaches and techniques, and being connected with the faculty. This is one of the most amazing occupational science and occupational therapy faculties in the world, in the country for sure, but in the world. So I thought, this is really neat. I would love to be a TA. So I was asked actually to be a TA the following year when I was in the doctoral program, and I graciously accepted. And I think it started there. Well, it didn't start there. It just continued there, I guess. And then part of my residency process was teaching. So I wanted to teach adults how to learn occupational therapy and occupational science. And that became my residency. I was one of the first doctoral residents in this department to do a track in education. So I studied curriculum design. I studied teaching pedagogy, and I studied outcomes and how to measure a student's understanding and knowledge. And it was great because I took a course, a one-on-one course with the director of medical education, who was here at the time. And I just met with him in his office once a week. And we talked about how to write objectives for each week, how to create a syllabus, how to create learning modules, and then how to measure and assess the student's knowledge. And it was probably one of the best experiences of my career. And then for my residency, I taught a course at the Ohio State. I developed a course and then taught it at the Ohio State University, which they still, they wanted to hold on to the syllabus, and they asked if they could keep the course there. And I was like, heck yeah, as long as my name's still on it. And then I taught there for that one quarter. They were on quarter systems. And then when I moved to Towson, I applied for an adjunct faculty position, and I taught two different courses there, one for the undergrads in health and leisure, which was a lot of fun, and then another course on standardized assessment tools in the OT program. And it was an evening course, so I worked full-time at the hospital and then ran to Towson University in the evenings. That was like my dream job, to work in the hospital full-time and then have that teaching at the in the evenings. I was totally in flow. It was great. And then I met my husband. Well, we were dating at the time, and he knew he had to come back out here for his residency. So I emailed Dr. McLaughlin Gray, and I asked her, would there be any opportunities to teach at USC if I would move back to LA? If this relationship was going to go further, I'd probably get married to the guy, and I'd be back in LA. Well, sure enough, they wanted me to apply for the full-time faculty position that was open. And so now I teach the adult rehabilitation and geriatrics course, and I teach kinesiology to the juniors and to the students who come in the summer, as you know.
Well, that's a very sort of acclaimed background, things that you went through to become a professor. It seems very elaborate. What kind of advice would you give someone who's either thinking about going back for an OTD, who wants to be a teacher someday? Yeah. What kind of advice can you give based on your history?
Sure. I would say that the more you can be present in a classroom and the more that you can learn from really sharp clinicians, take those opportunities, do it. Volunteer for it. You're not going to get these paid positions anymore where you can, you know, where you can do what you love doing and make the money that you want to make. So it might be something extra where you do just go sit in on a classroom, or you find this mentor that will allow you to come into the classroom and maybe take certain parts and teach certain parts. And it doesn't even have to be in academia. I don't think it needs to be in the setting, because we have clinical educators out there who do in-services, brown bag lunches, who teach fieldwork students and have one-on-one interactions every hour of every workday for 12 weeks. So take those opportunities to be fieldwork educators. We need fieldwork educators. Go to continuing education courses. Network at OTAC conference or AOTA conferences. Join the special interest section. There's a special interest section at AOTA for people in education and academia. But I think it could be something that you do in the classroom or in the clinic. And I think it's very, very important in both settings.
Nice.
So yeah, finding those opportunities, I think, is a great start. And finding a mentor, someone you can learn from and someone that will help you, you know, put the pieces together, and someone who could be a role model, who you could look at and say, I want to be just like that person when I grow up, when I have my own classroom. And I think that's a really important place to start.
And for you, having the teacher position, but also getting to still practice in a hospital is a big part of being the teacher and keeping up with the current education.
Absolutely. And I think that if you can bring those two worlds together, you become a stronger clinician and a stronger educator. You know, I recently bumped into one of my colleagues from a hospital where I worked, and she said, I know what I'm doing in the clinic, and I have the movements and I have the skill in the clinic, but I can't put the words to it because I've lost that ability because I haven't been in a classroom for so long. So I think it's important that you kind of try to bring both worlds together. And that's why I actually think the OTD is a brilliant degree, because it bridges the clinic and the classroom and sort of marries the two very nicely.
Let's talk more about clinical experience. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's just getting started, just graduated, just passed their test, and now they're out in the big world of occupational therapy. What's your advice as an experienced clinician?
Okay, my advice, where do I even start? I would have a lot of advice for a new grad, but I think the first most important thing is to make sure you're an AOTA member. The second thing I would say is make sure you are a member of your state association, whatever state you live and work in. My third thing would be latch on to the seasoned clinicians at your place of employment and just learn. Ask them if you can do co-treats. Ask them if you could sit in and watch when they're treating a very complex patient. Ask if you can have a hand with this really difficult case that you're kind of stuck with and you're not sure which direction to go. Be mentored. Don't shy away from learning from people who have experience or that are more seasoned. I oftentimes see in the clinic, like, people are just running around and they're really frantic about getting their caseload finished, and they've got all these people and all these notes, and all of a sudden you forget what you're doing there. It's like, hey, you're here to help people get better, but you're also here to be a better clinician. And I think that, unfortunately, with the way that healthcare is changing right now, a lot of time and energy is not devoted to continuing education. And a lot of employers no longer will pay for continuing education like they used to. They used to allot $1,000 a quarter or a semester or a year, whatever it was, for any CEU's continuing education units that you wanted. We'll pay for it. And then come back and show us what you learned and implement it here. So we used to get a lot of continuing education dollars. And right now, I don't know that anyone offers that anymore. So I would say get the hands-on experiences that you can from the OTs that work there, from the PTs that work there, from the speech therapists that work there. Learn from the nurses, learn from the doctors, learn from the interdisciplinary team, because that's the name of the game these days. And if you don't have those kinds of relationships and those kinds of communications with people you work with, you're not going to really enjoy what you do. You're not going to enjoy your work. I think you have to establish really good relationships where you work. And I think the best way to do that is to get to know people and to have people get to know you. Go to happy hour with them. You know, go for a walk at lunchtime. Ask, can we have a journal club every Thursday from 12 to 1? Bring in a cool article and have everyone read it. Be that nerd. Be that nerd that wants to learn more, because you will really thrive in your workplace and you will be asked to be on committees and do extra projects. Do them. Don't have the expectation that I work 40 hours a week and then I go home. That's a job. This, my friend, is your career. And you love your career. And it's not 40 hours a week. It's whatever it takes to get it done. And it's whatever it takes to know what you're going to do tomorrow with that patient that you don't know what to do with. It's whatever it takes to meet your minutes for that day, get your paperwork done, and then go home. You do whatever it takes. I think we have to change our expectations, because it's not the same workplace it used to be. Did I answer your question?
I'd say so.
Yeah. And stay connected. Go to conference. Come back for these continuing education, you know, courses or workshops. Go to the symposiums. Go to the legislative receptions. Get involved. Get connected. And that's how we become more powerful. And I don't know how to survive without doing those things. I think this is what we need to do in order to survive.
Does that kind of go hand in hand with what you would say to someone who's been in the practice for longer? A lot of times we address people who are just getting into occupational therapy practice, yeah. But what about someone who's been around for 8 or 10 years and they kind of find themselves getting into a rut, as I think is probably common in the practice?
Yeah.
What is some advice you can give to them as someone who's kind of been through that phase yourself?
Yeah. I think when I found myself being in a rut, I went back to school and got a master's degree. And that's what was sort of my catalyst to come back to school. I felt burnt out. I felt fried in my acute inpatient hospital setting. I felt like I wasn't sure what OT's role was on a team in the hospital. And I felt really lost, and I wasn't sure I wanted to stay in occupational therapy. Boy, was I like completely, you know, I was in another world. And I feel like, because I sort of shifted gears and became a student again, that it sort of rejuvenated my passion for what I was doing. And then I started to understand more the reasons why I was doing the kinds of interventions that I was doing versus just going in and doing ADLs or, you know, helping someone brush their teeth and put their pants on in the hospital and not really making a connection between how that's so important for a person's well-being and health. And I think going back to school and learning more about occupational science was my saving grace. I would say for a burnt out, seasoned clinician, either switch practice settings or go back to school. Go to conference, go to AOTA conference, go to a specialty conference. Like there's a specialty conference this weekend in San Antonio on, it's for post-traumatic stress disorders and veterans who are returning with spinal cord injury and amputations. And it's just for that population of clients. So I think there are specialty conferences all over. There's, you know, you could find specialty conferences for autism, for spinal cord injury, for brain injury, you name it, it's out there. Seek out those opportunities. Challenge yourself in a different way. If you've been a staff clinician, apply for a supervisor. Become management. Take on a fieldwork student. Do some continuing education courses online. Do a destination course. Go to Hawaii and learn myofascial release. You know, there's so many opportunities to do so many cool things. Get involved with your state association. I think that was also something that helped me when I moved to California. I didn't know many people. I think I knew my old professors, my former professors, and I knew some students that still lived in the area that I'd gone to school with. But when I joined OTAC, I met a lot of amazing people, and I now have a larger circle of OT friends, and I'm more connected and networked with them, and it's given me a different challenge. And now I challenge my students, and I say, hey, this is what OTAC's doing for me. Why don't you give it a shot and see what you think and get involved and stay involved? So I think that when you find that you're in a rut, find another challenge, because you're on autopilot, and sometimes autopilot's unhealthy. I mean, I had a friend who fell asleep once when he was behind the wheel. He was on autopilot and he fell asleep and he got into a car accident. So avoid the car accident. Get out of autopilot. Be alert. Be on your game. Challenge yourself in different ways. And hopefully you'll find that sort of refreshing course or that experience or that interaction you had with that one person, and you'll move into something new. I think OT is very cool that way, because if you are in adults and in rehab and the geriatric scene, you can completely switch and go to the opposite end of the lifespan and work with the little people. And if the little people aren't the thing for you, then go ahead and get into mental health. And if mental health isn't your thing, you can work at the zoo. If the zoo is not, you know, animals need meaningful occupation too, you know? And so you can market, and an OT can market him or herself in just about any arena under the sun. You just have to know how to market your skills and then how to use your skills to fit that setting. I think OTs can work just about anywhere. Everybody needs an OT.
Well, and isn't that what occupational therapy is all about, really, is staying engaged and staying stimulated? So it's important to remember to keep that in mind for yourself and not just for your clients, right?
I mean, we're the toughest people to practice what we preach. But yeah, when you are engaged in meaningful occupation or meaningful activity, you stay happier and healthier for a longer period of time. And so if you're finding yourself unhappy where you are, make a change. Go through the trans-theoretical model of change. Analyze your behaviors. Why are you not happy? And how can you move in a different direction? And I think that's important. I think you're right. You make a really good point. You have to be happy in what you're doing. And most OTs, I would say 99.9% of OTs I've ever met are so happy with their job, with their careers. They love what they do on a day-to-day basis. And if you're finding that you're not feeling that way, make a change.
And it's great that there's so many places to choose from and so many different things, like you said, so many different places you can get involved.
There really are. There's no excuse. You can find something if you look and if you try and if you want it. Yeah, I do believe that.
You're listening to OT Talk. Send any questions, comments, or ideas for future shows to uscotpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be right back.
Well, we talked a little bit about your work and teaching, but take us to your house. What's your home life like? And I understand you have a new son. How has that affected your practice?
Sure. So I'm married. I got married in 2008, and my spouse is a physician. So that's been interesting because he's always telling me things from a medical model kind of perspective, and I'm more on the rehabilitation social model almost perspective. And so he's learned a lot from me, and I've learned a lot from him, but he's probably the most informed physician on occupational therapy that you would ever meet. And he understands that it's not just PT slash OT, that we're a different profession than physical therapy, because I think a lot of times physicians in acute care hospitals really don't get it. So they'll just order PT slash OT and then think that, oh, the person can walk, they can go home. So my husband totally gets it now, and he actually will write orders like occupational therapy for lifestyle redesign on his chart, and then he'll say, but nobody gets it. So that's been really an interesting dynamic in our marriage, because we both are healthcare professionals coming from two different sides of the spectrum. And then, yes, you are correct. I have an 8.5-month-old son named Dean. And I used to tell my students every summer before I taught kinesiology that I never did peds as a clinician because little people scare me. So when I was pregnant, I actually was pregnant during kinesiology, but nobody knew it yet. And I would stand there and give my spiel about how I'm so afraid of little people, and I don't know how to talk to them, and I don't know how to work with them, and I don't know how to move their bodies because they're so little. Meanwhile, there's like a little fetus, you know, and I'm thinking, why, these kids have no idea how afraid I am of, you know, little people. Anyway, so I'm not afraid anymore of little people because I've learned to handle Dean now with delicate hands, and it's been fun. I'm learning a lot, and actually it forces me to go back to my pediatric books and all of my, you know, my resources that I haven't looked at since 1997 when I was in OT school, to look up milestones and to look up what's the kid supposed to be doing at this age, and should he be crawling or creeping or moving backwards or doing hand-to-hand, like bilateral whatever at midline? And so all of these things I'm sort of revisiting as a parent, and it's been really cool.
Sounds like he's going to have a very interesting childhood.
That kid, you know what? He's a lot of fun. He's a lot of fun. He has a big personality, and I think that being an OT, it's like a double-edged sword, because I know enough that if there is something that's atypical, I think I'm going to spaz out and want all my friends to do assessments. But if everything's going well, I'm going to try to look for something because I know there's always something. So, and plus I'm married to a physician and he's going to be the same way. So it's like, okay, I guess he's more chill about things, really. He's, don't worry about it. He's a kid. Kids change. And I'm like, wait a second, though. He hasn't had a bowel movement in 3 days. That's not normal. So yeah, the kid is going to have an interesting upbringing, that's for sure. But it's been fun. And he's enriched my life, I think, in another way, where I'm totally interested now in sensory integration and feeding strategies and sitting positions for meal times. And I think of a lot of things that I've never thought about in this way, because there's a third person at the table now.
Has that impacted your practice in rehabilitation at all?
I can't say that it's changed, it's impacted the way that I practice, but I think if I know that a person is a mother, or I know if a person's a father, that I think about different things now in terms of what their daily routines might be, or what their roles are, or how they do their day-to-day activities, because I know I can't just sleep in until 6:30 and be out the door by 6:45 anymore. It's like, you got to get up at 5:30, get the kids' bottles, get his diaper bag, make sure he's changed and in his clothes. So I think that I have a different kind of respect for parents. And if my clients are parents, I feel like I might look at their daily habits and their routines. And when I'm taking an occupational history, I think it really impacts how I think of their plan of care and what they might need when they go home.
Well, you're a very busy woman. How do you balance all of the commitments between OTAC and your work and your home life? How do you balance all of that successfully?
I wouldn't say successfully. You know what? I think OT is sometimes really funny about this balance of work, rest, and play, because we're the first group of people who don't practice what we preach. I would like to say that I try really hard to have a balance, but sometimes I think my work is my leisure, because I really enjoy my work. So I don't know how to answer that question. I do what I have to do for work every day, and I make sure that I'm ready for the next day. And if that means I'm up till 2 a.m. or 3 a.m, that's what happens. But it's pure adrenaline at that point. Now, it's not like I'm dragging or like miserable. It's exciting for me, and I'm with all of my resources, especially with kinesiology. I'm like, wait a minute, there's another book I need to look up. And so I think that it's that adrenaline and it's that passion that sort of makes your work and your leisure almost that slash, like work slash leisure, not comma. But I do love to hang out with my kid. Now I feel awful when I'm at my computer doing emails and he's sitting on the floor doing all these goo-goos and gagas. And I'm like, wait, I have 15 more emails. So that's been kind of tough, but I do my emails when he sleeps. And that means I don't sleep as much as I used to, but I feel like it's okay at this point in my life because coffee is good food and that helps. And my husband is really amazing and he helps out a lot with the instrumental activities of daily living in the home, like cooking and grocery shopping and cleaning. He's really awesome about being a great support when I have things that I need to do and attend meetings or conferences or whatever. But I think that going to the beach and riding my bike and hanging out with my kid, that's it. That's like my leisure. And if I can do that, I'll feel balanced.
Well, we know you've been doing physical rehabilitation for most of your career. Have you ever thought about any other areas of practice?
Yeah, I think recently, aside from having Dean and then kind of being interested in the pediatric area, I don't know that I could ever do peds, but so recently I've had an itch to sort of learn more about primary care and occupational therapy's role in primary care. We're hearing more and more about how there's these collaborations where wouldn't it be amazing if you went to the doctor and if you did say, I'll just give you an example. And so you went to the doctor and they take your blood pressure. You've gone to a primary care doctor and the guy says, you know what? Your blood pressure is bordering on hypertensive. You're at 140 over 90. I'm going to put you on this first line drug, some kind of beta blocker to try and control your blood pressure. And so in my mind and in the minds of an OT working in primary care, we'd love to see that instead of putting a person on that beta blocker, why don't you go right next door? There's an OT there and an OT can do an assessment with you and figure out what you do every day. What are your habits? What are your roles? What are your routines? How do you manage your stress? Do you have kids? Are you married? Do you have a partner? Do you have support at home? Are you in school? Do you have financial problems? So that there's a true analysis and an occupational history that's very thorough. And then they can help you change your habits or help you figure out how to include stress management in your day or how to include exercise, teach you how to choose healthy foods so that you can help to control that blood pressure without medications. And instead of prescribing medications, maybe we prescribe meaningful activity and we prescribe occupations. And I think recently, because of what's happened with my father, he was diagnosed with hypertension in his early 20s, and he was always put on a different kind of medication to try to control his blood pressure. So he would be on one medicine that wasn't working anymore. He would be on two different kinds of medications, three. In the last 4 years, I would say that it crawled up to being on 11 different kinds of medications just to control his chronic hypertension. Now, my dad, of course, was at fault for his health because he was a smoker and he didn't watch his diet. And he was overweight and he had a lot of stress in his life. He had 4 kids. He had his own business. He was a caregiver for his own mother. He's married. And so all the things that come with raising kids, having a house keeping up a household, that's really stressful. And if you don't know how to deal with it, hey, your blood pressure goes up. So I think that he didn't know. And I feel bad saying that he was at fault. I don't know that he was at fault. I think he didn't know how to change. And he didn't know that you can adopt different strategies in your life and that there are these wonderful people named OTs that can help.
And it's not easy to make that kind of change either.
Of course it's not. Nobody knows how to do it. Because you go to the doctor and he says, you need to lose 20 pounds. I'll see you in 3 months. How do you do that? So I feel bad saying it was his fault. I don't think it was his fault. I kind of want to blame it on Western medicine. You know, because I think it's common practice to say, here's some medicine to control your blood pressure. See you in 3 months. So that part of it is, if I could write a book, I think it would be called How Western Medicine, you know, Killed My Father or something like that. But that wouldn't be right. But I really think that he could have done something if he had the right tools. And even though I am an OT and I was his and I am his daughter, I couldn't reach him because I don't think you can intervene with a family member. I think it gets really tough. So he would sarcastically and very like, he would be very funny about it whenever I walked in and he's smoking a cigarette and I would sit down and say, you know what, Dad? And he would say, here she goes, the professor again, another lecture, you know, and he would make it funny, but he didn't want to hear it. And he never wanted to hear it from me. And as many times as I tried, Dad, let's look at the foods you eat. Let's look at how you could incorporate more exercise in your day. Let's look at smoking cessation. It wasn't something I could talk to him about because he was instantly turned off. So I wished that he had an OT, and I wished that that OT could have done some teaching with him and taught him to quit smoking and deal with stress and eat healthier and exercise more. But anyway, bottom line was the hypertension was out of control. The medications were not working. He ended up going onto basically what amounts to life support because he was diagnosed with end-stage renal disease. His kidneys completely shut down and he could not manage. It was very complicated. And so it was almost like Pandora's box. When you start, you know, dialysis, a door opens and then you're just at risk for so many other things. So he ended up passing away this past February because of a heart attack. And so to me, I feel like if there was an OT working in primary care somewhere where my dad was 20 years ago, that maybe he could have controlled his hypertension in a different way and changed his life for the good. And that he wouldn't have been in the situation that he was in just a few months ago. So I'm really interested in occupational therapy and primary care for that reason, because it's really personal. And I feel like I'm on some kind of mission. And I feel like culturally speaking, I could reach a lot of Middle Eastern families because there are certain characteristics of my father as an Arab man who didn't want to hear it from his daughter. And I think that that can go a long way outside of just the primary care itself, but culturally educating a group of people who might not be able to change their habits or change their routines for whatever cultural reasons. So yes, that's definitely an area of practice that I would love to get into in the near future. And I don't know, try to get that experience so that I understand lifestyle redesign even more, because that hasn't been a primary practice area for me.
And lifestyle redesign is still kind of in its infancy right now. Yeah. And there are a lot of difficult factors that it's trying to overcome as it tries to establish itself in the marketplace, really.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it was developed here at the University of Southern California, and our practitioners at our USC OT faculty practice are implementing lifestyle redesign. And I think some of the bigger programs that we have over there are for weight management and diabetes, but that's not to, oh, and there's also a program for college students and stress management. But it's a program that, or it's an approach that is still sort of in its infancy, still making its way into healthcare settings. And I think primary care would be a beautiful fit for lifestyle redesign. And I know for sure that our clinicians and our administrators are working very hard at creating these collaborations in the LA area.
unfortunately, in the case like your father's, there's going to be some resistance to trying to change the system as it's already set up. That's going to be a big issue there.
Well, with a person, with people in general, yeah, because it's hard to change habits. But then in a system that's set up like ours and in our healthcare systems, it's really difficult to get prevention and preventative measures paid for by insurance companies, because usually they'll pay for after the fact. They'll pay for a splint after you have a contracture. They'll pay for a wheelchair after you have paralysis. They'll pay for things after you need it. And it's always rehabilitation and not prevention. So that needs to change in order for something like lifestyle redesign and preventative occupational therapy to really be put on the map in terms of healthcare in the United States. Is we need to get insurance companies to buy in and pay for it, because private payers are limited. You can't afford this kind of therapy. You can't afford prevention, because we're just barely making ends meet, you know, and especially now after such a recession and people are having financial difficulties, nobody wants to pay for something to prevent, because we're still trying to keep up with what we have to pay for after the fact. So I think that's a huge hurdle that we have to jump over, but we will jump over it. Guarantee you we will. It's not going to go anywhere. Hopefully with the Affordable Care Act and with things that are being implemented, I'm hoping that preventative OT is something in the forefront, in the center of, you know, all of the excitement, because we're in a prime situation to be doing exactly that, prevention.
Well, and that gets back to what we talked about earlier with a professional association making our voice as occupational therapists more powerful.
Absolutely. And if we had more occupational therapists working on Capitol Hill, and if we had more occupational therapists writing to their congresspeople and to the legislation in the state that they lived, if we had our voices heard by more policymakers, and if we were there sitting at the table with these policymakers, then we wouldn't be fighting these fights. And I think we would be in more of these practice settings where you go to the doctor and then you knock on the door right next door to the MD, there's the OT. And I think we can have those collaborations with much more ease if we can impact change in higher systems. For sure.
I say that's very well said. So what does an educated, empowered occupational therapist like yourself have for breakfast on a daily basis?
Well, we try to eat healthy. We try to eat healthy and empower ourselves, because we know that you are what you eat. So an empowered OT who does what I do will have some yogurt in the morning with fruit and granola. And I try very hard not to drink coffee, because coffee will increase my blood pressure, and I know I'm at risk for high blood pressure. But green tea works well. It gives you the caffeine boost. And I don't know. It gets dangerous in the copy room every once in a while. Someone brings in like the homemade cupcakes or the cookies or little snacks. So you try to have a little piece and move on. But for the most part, it's yogurt and granola and fruit.
Sounds great. Dr. Rafidi, thank you so much for joining us this
week.
We appreciate it.
And thanks for asking me to do this. It's been fun. And I look forward to this series. I think it's going to be wonderful.
Well, folks, that's a wrap for episode 1 of OT Talk. A big thank you to Dr. Samia Rafidi for being a fantastic opening guest. Also, our producer is Michael Urbano, and I am your host, Rob Russo. We'll see you next time on OT Talk.